Welcome to the Western Magazine Hour, stories and articles about the American West, produced at the Recording Library of West Texas.
Hello, this is Michael, and I am reading from True West Magazine's archives, December 1973 edition. Heist in a West Texas Sandstorm by Jerry M. Sullivan. The two men entered town with their backs to a biting southwestern wind that hurled rivulets of sand along the rutted, deserted street and sent the February chill straight to the bone. Not a single brave soul was on the street to witness the strangers emerging from the dust boiling up South Main, nor were they seen hitching their horses behind the frame building on the corner. The Seminole National Bank was about to be robbed. In 1912, while much of Texas had been well launched into the 20th century, the Llano Estacado remained firmly 19th century as far as lifestyle was concerned. An inveritable frontier, it had been less than 40 years since the last Indians had been forced out from that part of the plains by Colonel William R. Shafter, who in 1875 led a cleanup expedition into the region. Shafter's command discovered three groups of shallow, water-filled depressions and draws near the center of what was to become Gaines County. These spots of waters became known as Ward's Wells, McLean's Wells, and Seminole Wells, the latter named for the famous group of Seminole Negro scouts serving in Shafter's command. After the removal of the Indians, ranchers moved on to the lush, virgin grasslands of the plains, and by 1890, much of Gaines County was owned or under lease to Colonel C.C. Slaughter's Long S Ranch, with several small and medium-sized outfits scattered around Slaughter's spread. Not until 1905 was the area around the wells populated enough to organize a county, at which time the tiny settlement of Seminole was chosen the seat of government. 7 years later, at 2:30 on the cold, windblown Thursday afternoon of February 15, 1912, the two men entered the bank where John Haney was working alone. Usually the bank manager, Jim Williams, and a clerk, Alice Aidson, were on duty at that time, but Williams was sick and Miss Aidson was having a delayed lunch. One of the men had his face covered, and the other wore a red beard, believed by some to be false. They ordered Haney to face the wall while saddlebags were filled quickly with $3,500 in cash. Then they locked Haney in the vault and disappeared into the sandstorm. Not long after leaving the little town, the robbers spotted a rider driving a bull and skirted around him to avoid contact. Cleve Cobb, the local rancher, thought at the time the pair behaved oddly. By the time he arrived in Seminole, the town was in an uproar. About a half hour after the robbery, a Mr. White entered the bank on business, discovered what had happened, and summoned Sheriff Frank Lord. Sheriff Lord hastily assembled a posse and gave pursuit. Several of those pressed into service soon gave up and returned to Seminole. But Lord and his deputy, Dick Consinot, continued the chase, catching sight of the two, but losing them in the blowing sand after Consinot's horse gave out. The lawman walked to C.M. Brecken's ranch house nearby, spent the night, and resumed the chase the next day, riding several miles into New Mexico before turning back to Texas. When Lord and Consinot returned to Seminole, the townspeople were up in arms and had started carrying sidearms in the old style. All telephone wires out of town had been cut, except the one which led to the northwest, and New Mexico authorities had been notified of the holdup. On Saturday the 17th, a wire was received from Sheriff Stewart of Eddy County, New Mexico, that two men, fitting the description, had been seen passing the Hobbs post office on Thursday about 9 p.m., and again at a ranch house north of Monument Springs about 2 hours later. Stewart said he was in the vicinity when he heard about the robbery and investigated to no avail before returning to Eddie, present-day Carlsbad. Within a week, $1,200 in rewards had been posted for the outlaws, $500 each by Governor Colquitt and the Texas Bankers Association, and $200 by the Fidelity and Casualty Company of New York, insurers of the bank. Many of the citizens in the Seminole area believed that more than two men were involved in the robbery. This allegation was based on the belief that the two men probably knew that only one person would be in the bank, and because of the precaution they took of cutting the telephone wires. As a result, a member of the prominent area ranching family was indicted on March 26th, but was acquitted for lack of evidence. 2 months passed without a clue. Then a body was found on the San Simon Ranch, northwest of Eunice, New Mexico, about 50 miles southwest of Seminole. The man was believed to be one of the robbers, killed for his share of the money. He was later identified as a man named Fuqua, but was never proven to have been one of the outlaws. Another body was found near Monument Springs, but again, no connection could be established with the Seminole robbery, nor was his murder ever solved. It was not until October 1913 that any new evidence came to light in the crime. The sheriff of Brewster County, in the Big Bend region west of the Pecos River, arrested a man near the Rio Grande who was thought to be one of the robbers. Sheriff J.M. Coker arrived in Seminole on October 14th from Sweetwater with the man in custody. The suspect denied any part of the offense and was confident he would be released as soon as he could get a hearing on a writ of habeas corpus. A hearing was scheduled for November 19th in Seminole with Circuit Judge Spencer presiding, but when the date came, defense witnesses did not appear. The hearing was rescheduled for December 4th and transferred to Lubbock, about 80 miles to the northeast. After John Haney identified this man as one of the robbers, the application for the writ of habeas corpus was withdrawn, and he was held until the Gaines County Court convened in the spring of 1914. But the case was again transferred to Lubbock, set for June 1st, obviously due to problems in jury selection. Things moved rapidly after that. The case was taken up by the district court on June 2nd, and at 11 a.m. on the 4th, it was turned over to the jury. At 3 that afternoon, the jury asked to be dismissed, as it was hopelessly deadlocked at 6-6. The request was granted, and the case carried over to the fall term of the court. When court was convened in the fall, the defense produced a witness who testified that the accused had been working with him in a railroad construction gang near Del Rio at the time of the Seminole National Bank robbery. The defendant was subsequently acquitted, but the residents of Seminole went home with many still believing that though others had a hand in the holdup, the man just released was also guilty. So the truth remains hidden in the sand, stirred violently on that cold day in February. True West Magazine Archives, December 1973 edition. The Disappearance of Eugene Wilson by Carolyn F. Ballou. The Rocky Mountains of southwestern Colorado hold many unsolved mysteries, but the disappearance of Eugene P. Wilson from his small cabin near beautiful Lake Fork of the Gunnison River on June 2, 1967, is one of the most baffling of them all. The 74-year-old bachelor has not been heard from since he vanished from his ranch near Blue Mesa. Neither have authorities announced any suspects or any leads. Neighboring ranchers in the Lake Fork country north of Lake City, Colorado, are concerned and fearful about the fate of their longtime friend. Was Eugene Wilson murdered by a drifter for his small Social Security check and his weighted body thrown into the Blue Mesa Reservoir? Or Did he meet death in a treacherous mountain crevice beside a well-traveled road? Was the old-timer disposed of in the rugged mountainous region of his own 800-acre ranch by rustlers caught in the act of stealing his cattle? Or was he taken to Utah in search of a gold cache and his body dumped into an abandoned mine shaft? The families in the once peaceful vicinity between Lake City and Powderhorn will not feel secure again until the mystery is solved. Wilson was born near the Lake Fork River in 1893, and that is where he spent his life, except for a few years in Canyon City attending school. He liked to hunt and fish, and he knew every nook and cranny in the high country surrounding the cabin where he lived alone. His only brother, Walter R. Wilson, had lived in a cabin nearby until 1947, when he was killed by hunters while riding horseback near the Lake Fork River. The surviving brother occupied his time raising cattle and hay for himself and neighboring ranchers. What may have seemed like a lonely life to others was a normal life for Gene. Occasionally, he walked down by the river and visited with the Clarence Spaulding family, where he would enjoy a home-cooked meal. He rode his gray, sway-backed horse or walked everywhere he went, except when given a ride by one of his neighbors. Lowell Carr and his wife Martha, who had known Gene for many years. Lowell, who formerly owned the ranch across the river from Wilson's place, has been his friend for 60 years and often drove the old-timer into Gunnison to transact business. On other occasions, they drove in Carr's pickup truck to Fred Uman's General Store in Powderhorn, 14 miles away. Wilson carried little cash. He wrote checks for groceries and supplies, which he purchased in large quantities from Uman's wife Peggy and daughter Bobby. Even small purchases were paid for by check. Everyone around there knew Wilson to be a kind old man who loved children and animals. Some thought he was a rich bachelor. Tragedy struck the Wilson Ranch on May 7, 1965, when Wilson's log cabin burned to the ground during a violent windstorm. He was at the corral when a stovepipe blew off, set the cabin on fire, and destroyed everything he owned except the livestock and the clothes on his back. The following summer, Wilson engaged a contractor to build a new house and some fences. A small two-room modern house with a partial dirt cellar replaced the old log cabin. Drifters were hired to do the work. In the fall of the following year, Wilson left for Arizona and Utah looking for a gold cache. Some of his friends believe he had the cache that he had long dreamed of finding, located within a 40-acre tract of land. He said that it was located in Utah, on a site where Colorado, Utah, and Wyoming join. Wilson returned to Colorado throughout the winter months and made plans for a return trip to Utah in the spring or early summer of 1967. He discussed the proposed trip with Basil Hicks, a bachelor and longtime friend who lived in a log cabin higher up in the mountains. "I'm going to Utah in June to do some prospecting," Wilson had said to Hicks. "If my ride doesn't show up, will you take me?" Hicks assured him that he would. Others along the Lake Fork River had also heard Wilson speak of his longtime dream of finding gold. A few weeks before he vanished, Wilson sold his ranch to A.E. Thomas, an Albuquerque businessman. Thomas told Wilson he could continue living in the cabin as long as he wished. However, the old Lake Fork native had other plans. He had never liked the new green cabin with its modern fixtures. "He hated it," exclaimed one of his neighbors. Some logs had already been cut for a new cabin he planned to build on the flats higher up in the mountains. Wilson had a longing to move back to the old home place where he had grown up. The site of the proposed cabin was a quarter mile from the place where his parents had lived. Powderhorn rancher George Gray, who worked for Thomas, is the last person known to have seen Eugene Wilson alive. When Gray went over to Wilson's ranch to talk to him about a tractor on the evening of June 2nd, 1967, he did not notice anything unusual about Wilson. The old fellow said nothing about leaving. Wilson was expecting his Social Security check on June 3rd, when Thomas's nephew, Bill Thomas, arrived at Wilson's cabin that Saturday morning to take Wilson into Gunnison on business. The old fellow was not there. It was not unusual for Wilson to leave and be gone for a couple of weeks, but he was seldom gone for more than 3 weeks at a time. When Basil Hicks did not see Wilson around his cabin, he assumed that he had gone to Utah as planned. However, as the weeks went by, Wilson's neighbors noticed that his horse was still in the pasture and his cats were starving. They became concerned and wondered what had happened to him. Since that old horse was Wilson's only means of transportation, he always kept it in the corral and carried the saddle to the house with him. When the suspicious ranchers began to look around Wilson's place, they found a saddle out in the corral by the loading chute. They knocked on the cabin door, but there was no answer. The electricity was turned off outside, as was his habit every time he left, for he feared lightning would strike his cabin. A key had been left in the usual place outside the door, so they went inside. There was no trace of him inside or out, and everything was just as he had left it, even the overalls that he wore regularly. His eyeglasses, a jacket, magnifying glass, two razors, two pairs of new shoes, a box containing a few cartridges, and his homemade walking stick were left intact. The horse had stepped on Wilson's foot a few days before he disappeared, and he could not walk well without the support of the cane. Other than that, he was in excellent health and quite active for a man of his age. A money bag made out of new blue jean material and stitched on three sides, containing nickels, dimes, and pennies, were found on a table beside his bed. But his worn leather money pouch, his sleeping bag, and a borrowed 98 Mauser rifle were not found. The old rancher had known for some time that rustlers were stealing cattle from him, and his neighbor said this disturbed him. When the ranchers realized that something must have happened to Wilson, they notified authorities. On June 9th, a week after Wilson was last seen, his Social Security check was cashed at the Superfood Market in Gunnison. "We believe the endorsement was forged," said Sheriff George Cope. "Someone probably talked Wilson into going with them. I formed a search and rescue team in July after he disappeared, and the 65 people in the party searched a four-mile radius around his cabin. This search by men on foot, most of whom were not familiar with the rugged Lake Fork country, was not effective, however. No clues were found. Some of Wilson's friends also made a search of the mountainous region on horseback. One man said, "Only an old-timer who knows the country well would know where to search for Gene." But some who knew the country best were not asked to join in the search. A.E. Thomas and a group of men forded the Lake Fork River on horseback, searching up one bank and down the other, but nobody was found. At the time Wilson vanished, the swift water had been swollen from spring rains and melting snow. When Wilson failed to return, George Gray went over to his place to irrigate and care for the garden, but it went to weeds in spite of his efforts. By September, copies of the Denver Post were stacked 2 feet high at the Powderhorn post office. The subscription was canceled and a refund sent to his nearest next of kin, Mrs. Earl Thomas, a sister living 60 miles away. Even after a year had passed, she still held hope that her brother was alive. But now there remains little chance that Eugene Wilson could still be living. Mrs. Thomas, no relation to A.E. Thomas, would find some relief in knowing what really happened to her brother. Folks around Lake City and Powderhorn expressed various opinions concerning Wilson's disappearance. One person said, "I don't think his body is too far away. It may be on his own land. There are two cellars there that have caved in." "I wish I had listened to him now," reflects one old-timer. "He came over to my place a day or two before he disappeared and talked about wanting to go to Utah. But I didn't think there was anything to it at the time. I don't believe his check was forged at all. I think he cashed it himself and went to Utah as planned to claim what he found on his first prospecting trip." Someone else raised the question, could the unidentified body found at Moab, Utah, be Wilson's? He could easily be identified by his thick gray hair, ruddy complexion, and his few remaining teeth. Still another friend commented anxiously, "We all wish that they could find what happened to him. He was such a nice person, and we can't understand why anyone would want to harm him. But we feel that someone, somewhere, must know what happened." Though there are numerous theories as to the fate of the kind old bachelor, all who knew him fear that Eugene Wilson met with foul play. "Looks like we aren't even to know where he might be buried," said his sister. Since sportsmen from various parts of the United States vacation near the Lake Fork of the Gunnison River each year, perhaps someone will come up with information concerning the missing gray-eyed rancher who stood 5'8" and weighed 160 to 175 pounds. The smallest clue may be the missing link that will solve the baffling mystery. True West Magazine Archives, December 1973 edition. Bandit with the Post Hole Banks by Ford Green. With the end of the war to end all wars came the wildest era of lawlessness that our country had ever seen. Bootlegging and the hijacking of bootleg goods and profits led the way. And since most people winked at the illegalities of the bootlegging industry, those engaged in it soon graduated to bigger and better things. It really was a very short step from hijacking a load of booze to sticking up a bank. At first, for the most part, the victims were little tin can banks, but the green stuff from one of them was just as good as that from the biggest city depository. Individually, there might not be much of a haul, but the risk was comparatively small, and there was always another country bank not too far off, especially as the quality of automobiles improved. In these times, there lived a lawman who was the link between the Old West and the modern era. He was a native of San Angelo, Texas, whose father died as a result of an arrow wound while fighting as a ranger. At the age of 16, this youngster enlisted in the Spanish-American War for a short term. 2 years later, he was hired as one of the agents to track down the Black Jack Ketchum gang. From that, he graduated to be a city marshal, deputy sheriff, and before he was 30, to serving with Customs and Immigration. When his career eventually culminated in his joining the FBI, he served under Bruce Bilsko and William J. Burns, and he was picked by J. Edgar Hoover as one of the original 40. Before he retired, after World War II, he was a legend. And where men gather who knew him, he is still a legend. Gus T. Buster Jones. Gus was a friend of my father, and from time to time I visited his office, as well as phoning him in his later years after retirement. One of his big coups was the Urschel kidnapping, but what made him mellow was a bank robber he caught in the windup of that case, a man who really had very little to do with the actual crime, Harvey Bailey. In the raid, Gus Jones caught Harvey Bailey asleep and took a Thompson submachine gun from his bed and woke him up with it. And after that was over, Gus kept the gun for a souvenir and always called it by the affectionate name of Harvey. He also told me other tales of this man and his robberies, mainly having to do with his hidden loot. Most of the gunslinging bank robbers of the 1920s got their weapons training during World War I. Of course, there was always the chance of murder with so many guns pointing around, but the average bank robber was not willingly a murderer. We don't have much on Harvey Bailey before 1920, when the bootlegging racket was fairly firmly established. We do know that he was from West Virginia, born in 1887, and that shortly after the turn of the century, his family moved to Missouri. Later, he moved to Omaha, where he worked for the railroad until 1920, when he was fired after a bootlegging arrest. Though he lost his job, Harvey escaped a jail sentence and headed for bigger things. He was always in touch with his family. In fact, his first expansion with the profits of bootlegging was to set his brother up in a delivery business and automobile agency in Iowa. Bailey was a merry, backslapping handshaker who was everybody's friend. He was liked in all the bootlegging circles who were on the buying end of his running alky to Chicago, corn liquor from the Hill Country, or beer from St. Louis. Bailey covered the whole market. However, changes were coming. Gangs were taking over Chicago and later would set up the Capone organization to front for them. More to the immediate point, an increasing number of bootleggers were complaining via the grapevine that an increasing percentage of Harvey Bailey's stock was hijacked from themselves. There could have been some truth to this, because in late October 1920, Harvey was arrested again for hijacking and robbery. As earlier, Bailey must have had good lawyers, for the cases were thrown out of court. After this bout, he began to take a closer look at other avenues for profit. Though he liked the good times of bootlegging, its limitations were evident. He had seen the way some of the big-time operators in Chicago were living, and it interested him. There was one very necessary ingredient, of course, money. And money came from banks. By now, there was little concerning crime, organized or otherwise, in the central United States with which Bailey was not thoroughly familiar. On his many trips to Chicago, he had become acquainted with all the crime greats. Frank Nash, Vern Miller, Terrible Tommy Tui, Jim Ripley, Eddie Dahl, Tom Holden, Count Lustig, Eddie Bentz, and Francis Keating. These were at the top of the list, but undoubtedly there were others not recorded as being in direct contact with Harvey Bailey. Bailey started his climb into the fraternity in the usual way, from the bottom. His first steps were as getaway driver, where there was not too much of a chance for a disastrous slip-up. The experienced older hands handled the guns and made the plans. Soon he was advanced to the job of scoop-up man, though others still handled the guns and did the planning. While they covered the victims, Bailey's job was to get the money and stay out of the line of fire in case there was any shooting. From there, he went on to the gun handling jobs, and finally to the most important of all, the front man. In this assignment, he was running the whole bit. The first man in and the last man out. He had to watch his Confederates, as well as the bank people, acting as a balance wheel to keep down the shooting if possible. Most of the time, the front man didn't want shooting by one of his men any more than he wanted some hero in the bank starting the fireworks. At the end of 1920, Bailey was a full-fledged bank robber, with a yearly take of nearly six figures, if not more. By 1925, he was able to run the whole operation and call in other top-flight professionals to help with jobs as the occasion demanded. He had arrived. Several men had their own loose organizations, swapping people from one to the other, so that very rarely were the same men in the same positions in successive robberies. Bailey or some other principal would decide to pull a job. After the location had been surveyed by him and another experienced man, they would get on long distance and put together a group to pull the job. After it was done, everyone would go his separate way for a week or 10 days, and then, by means of long distance, decide where to get together again for the split. One outstanding thing about Harvey Bailey is the fact that he was always trusted to carry the whole proceeds of the holdup, no matter who else was present. Such trust by the underworld was almost unknown. Truly a rare case of honor among thieves. Bailey was an accepted and sought-after expert in the bank robbing field all over the Midwest by 1925. It is generally conceded that his share of the take was never less than $100,000 a year after 1921. And before he was taken out of circulation, it had climbed to several times that. He pulled from 8 to 12 major holdups a year. Bailey was identified as the getaway driver of the bunch who tapped the Denver Mint for $200,000 in December 1922 while he was in his apprenticeship period. In September 1931, after somewhere between 80 and 90 jobs in between, he relieved the Lincoln National Bank of $2 million. Harvey was identified as the leader of the men who robbed the Citizens National Bank of Fort Scott, Kansas in June 1932. He was always the professional. He ordered all the customers and employees to lie down on the floor so they couldn't be seen, and also for safety if shooting should start. He wanted no gunplay at all if possible. His range covered a wide area. There were hideouts from Wisconsin to West Texas, in Denver, Memphis, Hot Springs, St. Louis, and Chicago. When things got dull or too hot, there was always Florida or the West Coast. Along with several others of his circle, he liked to play golf, and a golf course was a good place to cool off, since few people, especially officers, associated these hot ones with this gentlemanly sport. With the kind of money Bailey had to spend, it was very hard not to assume any kind of pose that didn't take too much specialized education. He took a real interest in investing in real estate. The idea was to have a nest egg in case of injury or other forced retirement. To take care of his family and close circle of friends he trusted. And to have a line of safe hideouts. Nobody will ever know just where and how many of these farms he set up. There were two on the Illinois and Wisconsin border, with easy means of crossing from one side to the other. There were at least two in West Texas, as well as several others in between. The main necessities were a good bed and shelter for a car with plenty of gas and oil. But there was another use for these farms. Over the years, Bailey had come to be known as the post hole and or the thermos jug banker. These numerous farms that he used for cooling off had fence posts that were handy as markers when burying gallon jugs filled with the proceeds from bank robberies. Such containers could be widely dispersed, so that one was never too far away in case of the need of a withdrawal. Gus Jones said that nobody will ever know how many hundreds of thousands of dollars Harvey Bailey buried in this manner. Also, he doubts that Bailey told anybody, even members of his family, where even a sizable amount of this cash was hidden. It lay under the posts on farms all the way from Texas to Wisconsin. Bailey's was a treasure several times greater than the buried loot of Captain Kidd, and more than the loot of Jesse James, the Daltons, and Sam Bass all put together. When Gus told me this, he just half grinned and shook his head. In all probability, most of it is still waiting for a finder. By mid-1932, the meteoric career of Harvey Bailey was drawing to a close. The Fort Scott bank holdup in June brought about an alert for a bunch of government bonds, among other things. About 3 weeks later, two big-time Chicago hoods, Tom Holden and Francis Keating, with a companion, were teeing off on the golf course at Kansas City when they were surrounded by a posse. These two were wanted for a shootout escape from Leavenworth over 2 years earlier. Their companion claimed to be just an innocent acquaintance, but when the police shook him down, they found one of the Fort Scott government bonds with a surrender value of $1,000. His fingerprints were those of Harvey Bailey, and employees of the Fort Scott Bank identified him as the calm and efficient robber. It didn't take the judge and jury long to say 25 years, which he started at Kansas State Prison at Lansing. A man with the experience and connections of Harvey Bailey would not be long in learning the ropes of the inside. Along with a number of others, Harvey was put into a shop that manufactured twine out of sisal hemp. It was used for securing sheaves of corn and other grain and was known as a binder twine, a most necessary item on a farm. One day in May 1933, one of the bales of hemp made life a little more interesting, for concealed inside it was a handsome gift of 538 Smith & Wessons. A couple of days later, Bailey's group and several more escaped with some hostages after a minor firefight in which Bailey was wounded in the leg. Eventually, part of the gang made it to a hideout in Wise County, Texas. This farm was owned by a Mr. Shannon, who had a well-known son-in-law by the name of George Machine Gun Kelly. Soon, Bailey was off to one of his own farms to pick up a supply of working cash and a new Ford V8, which was quickly becoming the preferred transportation of the robber fraternity. The car was inconspicuous, plentiful, and fast. Soon after Harvey was back in circulation, one of the most historic crimes this country has seen took place, the Urschel kidnapping. Two men were in the same league with Bailey. Machine Gun Kelly and Albert Bates planned to get into the real big time by kidnapping a rich Oklahoma oil man. Federal heat had put on bank robbing and had cut down on its attraction. True, the Lindbergh Law had just been passed, but there had been no conviction under it, and it was still rather nebulous to the underworld. Bates and Kelly went to Oklahoma City and kidnapped Charles Urschel from the porch of his house at about 9 p.m. on July 22, 1933. Mrs. Urschel immediately telephoned J. Edgar Hoover in Washington, setting in motion one of the big manhunts of all time. The FBI men on the case were headed by Gus Jones, and they stood by until the ransom was paid and the oil man was freed. Then they got down to business. With the cooperation of Urschel, the federal investigation began to unearth some amazing facts. Though blindfolded during his captivity, Urschel heard a plane fly over every day and managed to ask the time on several occasions. One day there was a thunderstorm and it did not fly. He noted that one of the men talked about Texas politics. He also remembered certain details regarding the room in which he was held. By checking weather reports and airline schedules, the location of the farm was spotted. More FBI investigation turned up the fact that the farm was owned by Boss Shannon, the father-in-law of Machine Gun Kelly, who was wanted for a number of federal violations. The FBI was ready to move. In the 60 days, more or less, that Bailey had been in circulation, he had been pretty much on the move, and several times he had spent the night at the Shannon farm as a guest, but close enough to the operation to be asked to keep an eye on things while Kelly and Bates were off collecting the Urschel ransom money. Unluckily for him, he was magnificently rewarded for this small service with $1,000 of the ransom money when the split-up was made. The main kidnappers had left the farm just a few hours before the FBI posse headed by Gus Jones hit it. but Bailey had stayed on to get a night's sleep in the cool outdoors of the farmyard, with a .45 automatic under his pillow and a Tommy gun on the ground beside the cot. Gus Jones ran over to where Bailey was sleeping, picked up the machine gun and checked it, then roughly prodded its owner in the ribs with it. There was a looking match for a minute or so before Bailey resignedly said, "Aw, hell, Mr. Jones, a fellow has to sleep sometime." This was the submachine gun that Gus Jones kept for the rest of his service with the FBI, and he called it Harvey. Bailey was lodged in the Dallas County Jail along with several of the Urschel kidnappers, but bribed a guard to let him escape. Soon, however, he was picked up in Ardmore, Oklahoma, from where it was not even necessary to extradite him for trial in Oklahoma City with the rest of the kidnappers. By the end of September, they had all been rounded up, tried, and were headed for Leavenworth Federal Penitentiary. The leaders for life, and Harvey Bailey for 25 years. The prisoners served their sentences in various ways. In the fall of 1934, Harvey Bailey, along with a number of others, was transferred to the newly opened Alcatraz. Most of this bunch eventually returned to Leavenworth in 1952, Bailey among them because of the ransom money found in his pocket. By 1962, he had served his term for his part in the Urschel federal case, but then had to go to the Kansas State Penitentiary at Lansing to complete his sentence for the Fort Scott bank robbery of 1932, a sentence he had cut short in May 1933. By 1962, he was a white-haired, 76-year-old man, and only one deputy warden was needed to drive him those 6 miles between the prisons. A sad commentary on the man who had escaped from the escape-proof Dallas County Jail in Texas. About a year before Gus Jones died, he was reminiscing about the old days, and that is when he made the remark that nobody would ever know how much loot Harvey Bailey buried, and even poor old Harvey has probably forgotten where he buried most of it. So that will have to be the end of it, for Harvey Bailey, if still living, will be 86 years old, and those mileposts will have taken their toll on the fence posts, both in desire and location. Hello, this is Michael. I am reading from True West Magazine's archives, December 2009 edition. The Last Link to the Little Bighorn by Mark Boardman. He is the one living connection to the Battle of the Little Bighorn, or Custer's Last Stand, if you prefer. He's an old man now, 96, on October 27th. His hearing is bad, his eyes are weak, and he's been sick a fair amount in the past year. But Joe Medicine Crow's mind is clear, and his voice is strong as he tells the stories of that hot and dry day, June 25th, 1876, when a large force of Indians destroyed the U.S. 7th Cavalry in southeastern Montana. Medicine Crow heard the stories from the men who were there, both Custer foes and allies. Voices of the Elders. Medicine Crow's mind retreats to 1920, when he was 6 or 7 and living near Lodge Grass, Montana, about 5 miles from the battlefield. In the fall or spring, the old men gathered in the sweat lodges to purify their bodies and minds, to reminisce about the past and mourn for its loss. Usually, they recounted their bravery in battle. As you might expect, the Little Bighorn was a favorite subject. One of those men was his grandmother's stepbrother. Stay with us here. Who, by Crow tradition, is also considered his grandfather. White Man Runs Him, born around 1858, was one of Custer's scouts on the ill-fated mission. He took the boy Joe to the lodges to hear the tales. The elders said the problems began before the fighting started. White Man Runs Him insisted that Custer's soldiers had been drinking that day, Medicine Crow remembers. The men of the 7th weren't ready for a tough fight. Then the scouts went to a high point of rocks to spy on the Indian encampment and realized that they faced several thousand warriors. Just how many is still unclear. Custer didn't really believe them, and he certainly wasn't fazed. His only concern was that the Indian force might escape before he could get to them. Custer did not take the advice of his Crow scouts, who told him to wait for reinforcements before attacking the Sioux and Cheyenne camp, Medicine Crow says. Instead, he divided his force of 700 soldiers into three parts and attacked right away. The scouts knew what awaited. They began changing from army uniforms into their native clothing and singing their death songs. Custer asked an interpreter to explain the Indians' actions. When he was told, Custer accused them of being cowards and sent them away. That saved their lives. The last White Man Runs Him saw of Custer and his detail, they were charging toward the Little Bighorn River, heading for the huge Indian village. Estimates range from several hundred lodges to a couple thousands, and the stuff of legend. At that point, White Man Runs Him said, "We went back along the ridge and found Major Marcus Reno's men entrenched there. We stayed there all afternoon, fighting off the Indians. When darkness fell, the scout made his way through enemy lines and found troops coming to support Custer." It was a story that Joe Medicine Crow would hear many times. They didn't want to hear. Frequently, the young man served as interpreter for his grandfather, especially when white newspapermen and writers came for interviews about the Custer fight. Medicine Crow says that most refused to believe the stories, which flew in the face of the white image of Custer as a brave fighter who was ambushed by savages. Finally, White Man Runs Him had his fill. Facing a skeptical interviewer, he told the boy in Crow, "Send him home. He does not want to know the truth." The mid-60s man rarely spoke of the battle to whites after that. Medicine Crow faced similar disbelief throughout the years, yet he didn't stop telling the Crow stories. Feet in Two Worlds. Medicine Crow's relatives were not afraid to face the truth. The younger people would have to live in the white man's world. So while they brought them up with the old customs, speaking the Crow language and learning the way of the warrior, the elders sent the children to white schools. It was tough, Medicine Crow says. The Indian kids faced physical and emotional bullying from their mainly white peers and either indifference or discrimination from the teachers. Most dropped out. Medicine Crow stayed, but he didn't get his high school diploma until he was 21 years old. Then he became the second member of the tribe to attend college and the first to obtain a graduate degree, earning a master's in anthropology from the University of Southern California. He was well on his way to a PhD when World War II interrupted. Combat action in Europe provided an opportunity to bring his two worlds together and to prove his own worth as a warrior. In early 1945, Medicine Crow and the 103rd Army Division were driving through Germany, trying to finish up the war in Europe. He put war paint on his arms and a sacred eagle feather under his helmet, believing the strong medicine would protect him. It apparently did more than that. In an era of advanced warfare, Medicine Crow accomplished four tasks required of a Crow war chief: steal an enemy's horse, touch an enemy in battle, take away an enemy's weapon, and lead a successful war party. Nobody since has achieved that honor. It probably won't be done again. To this day, he proudly tells stories of his accomplishments in battle, just like White Man Runs Him and his other ancestors did. a 21st century crow. More honors have come Medicine Crow's way over the years, including his receipt of this year's Presidential Medal of Freedom, the nation's highest civilian honor. He's written numerous books and articles and given more interviews than one can count. In the oral tradition of his Crow tribe, he passes the story on to younger generations, Indian as well as white, who need to understand their history and culture if they are to be successful in the modern world. Joe Medicine Crow has already blazed that path, a nearly 100-year journey filled with great achievements. To conclude the story, I'm going to read a few photo captions and then conclude with a postscript. Photo gallery. This is a black and white picture of outside many men. Most of them are on the right side of this large rock type apparatus, dressed in Western clothing. It looks like early 20th century Western clothing. To the left is one man who is wearing the traditional Indian headgear. In November 1999, we were doing the groundbreaking, and Leonard Brugier, who was head of American Indian Studies at the University of South Dakota and the chair of the commission, was giving a speech. Up from the crowd comes Joe Medicine Crow, dressed in his World War II uniform. He walked up to Brugier and said, "I've come to sing an honor song for Custer." A hush came over the crowd. Leonard graciously stepped aside, and Joe sang this wonderful honor song for Custer in both Crow and English. We have a photograph, close-up photograph of an older man wearing a cowboy hat, jacket, sunglasses. Under that, we have another photograph of, looks like, two Western men and two Native Americans, and they are next to a monument for the Battle Memorial Site, the Custer Battle Memorial Site. Under that, we have a movie poster, Warner Brothers, Errol Flynn, Olivia de Havilland, they died with their boots on. This was a 1941 movie. Medicine Crow thought it might be fun and provide some pocket change, so he attended the audition. The producers were delighted to have an Indian show up, and even happier that he had actual connections to the Little Bighorn battle. They asked him to help with the script. Medicine Crow's efforts did not work out. The powers that be threw out historical accuracy in favor of a pro-military, patriotic approach, believing, correctly, that the U.S. entry into World War II was coming fast. Their Custer, played by Errol Flynn, would be a heroic figure, sacrificing himself for his country. When Medicine Crow told the producers that their depiction was way off, they fired him. I said, "Someday I'm going to write my own Custer production and tell it like it is." Medicine Crow grabbed his chance in 1964 when he authored the script for the Little Bighorn reenactment that still runs each June in Hardin, Montana. Before I read this final postscript, remember the article that we read is a story from True West Magazine's archives, published originally in 2009. This short postscript that I'll read, a part of a Wikipedia entry for Joe Medicine Crow. Medicine Crow continued to write and lecture at universities and public institutions until his death at age 102 on April 3rd, 2016. He was in hospice care in Billings, Montana. He is survived by his only son, Ron Medicine Crow, daughters Vermel Medicine Crow and Diane Reynolds, and stepdaughter Garnett Watton.
Thank you for joining us for the Western Magazine Hour. Stories and articles about the American West. Your narrator has been Jack. You can hear this program on Recording Library of West Texas Radio and on demand with your computer or favorite mobile device at recordinglibrary.org.